Don't be angry with me, little babe. Oh, look at her eyes.
So very dark and so very fierce-like. Her daddy's, that's for certain.
Yes. You must go soon.
Please, I beg you.
Tabitha.
I'm sorry.
Oh, see, you set her off again. Now, hush, hush. The baby is in your charge, Tabby. Carry her to Gondel. There, seek out my brother Gerald. Oh, I'm too weak to hold her. Take her now.
Come, my Ben.
This ring you must also convey as proof of who sent you. Gerald will know it, but on no account tell him who the baby's father was. Promise me you won't.
I promise.
Go then, Tabitha. And may God smile on you both.
Gondel by Martin Wade. With Diana Quick as Augusta, Janet Moore as Emily Bronte, Nathaniel Parker as Fernando, John Rowe as Lord Eldred, Clive Francis as Alfred, and Linda Polan as Tabitha.
The West Riding of Yorkshire, Howth, a village less than 4 miles south from Keighley. At the top of the hill, next the moor, the parish church. Next to the church, the graveyard. Next to the graveyard, the parsonage. It is almost 6 o'clock in the morning. This way, up the path to the front door. And into the hall. At the end of the hall, on your left, is the kitchen. The maid, Tabitha, will be in here soon, firing the oven, preparing breakfast. Very well. Upstairs now. This way. Tabitha will be awake, of course. And so, too, will Aunt Branwell, lying in bed with her well-thumbed Bible propped up in front of her. Past the clock at the turn of the stairs. It's 5 years and more now since her sister, Mrs. Bronte, fell ill, and Aunt Branwell... That's Tabby's room. That's Aunt Branwell's. 5 years, as I say, since she came from Cornwall to look after Mrs. Bronte, and also to take charge of the children. Now, in this room, over here, is the Reverend Bronte. And look, just outside the door...
He got them! Oh, hurrah, hurrah, hurrah!
A box, the present for young Branwell that Mr. Bronte promised to bring back from Leeds.
They've come! They're here!
Charlotte and Emily get out of bed. Anne sits up.
Soldiers, to replace those I lost.
Show me. How many are there?
12, and each one different.
Let us see. I ought to have one of them, don't you think, Branwell?
Just
one.
Oh,
I'll have this one.
No, wait.
He's mine. He's a great explorer. He's Captain Edward Parry. And this man...
Emily!
This tiny, tiny one... He is for Anne.
Thank you.
He will be man-in-waiting to my Captain Parry.
And so a game begins.
They must all have names, every one.
It's a game that is hard to stop.
Well, children, am I to throw all your breakfast in the slops bowl or what?
The best part of the day they devote to making out their game. And the next day, too. And the next. Cities spring up, are populated, are fought over from dawn till dusk. Games, other worlds, fusions of adventure, romance, the grotesque recent history, politics. An enterprise that is all-absorbing, more real than their real life. In the early days, they often play together, all four of them. But in time, Charlotte and Branwell devote themselves as much to writing about their heroes, or writing under their heroes' names, as acting out the adventures. So Emily and Anne begin to play on their own.
Hold fast, men! Trust in the Lord, and if you cannot do that, trust in me!
Lighty there directly by Captain Parry. Timbers on the starboard side!
Captain Parry peers out. Though his eyes are heavy with extreme fatigue and are stung by the ferocious rain, he spies a form clinging to a plank from the shipwreck. He shouts out. A voice answers.
Help.
A woman. Do you see her now?
Yes, Captain.
Help.
Look closely, unless I...
In my guess, she has a baby strapped to her back. Prepare to lower the lifeboat.
No, Captain!
Hold your tongue, man, and carry out the order.
The boat is lowered. The man in waiting, half protesting still, takes the oars, and Captain Parry, leaning over the edge of the boat, pushes at the giant timbers that block their route.
Take courage! We'll be with you soon!
But scarce has Parry uttered these words than the billow sweeps him off the boat and into the foaming main. And one of the shipwrecked boards, being tossed by a wave, strikes him full upon the head. And he loses consciousness and begins to drown.
Captain! Oh, my God!
Parry's distraught man in waiting sits in the lifeboat, torn between jumping overboard for his captain, attempting to rescue the woman and the baby, or, which appealed to him best, turning back to his ship.
Oh, what am I to do?
Have no fear!
We're done.
Though your captain is dead and already lies at the bottom of the ocean, yet he shall live again. For I am one of the good and mighty genii of Howard. I am Emily Jane Bronte. I give life and I take it away.
April the 3rd. We have come to an island, Gondor, the inhabitants call it. This region, at least, consists of wild moorland, home to the curlew and the skylark. Here heather grows and fern leaves, and grassy tussocks around the outcroppings of granite stone, not unlike parts of Yorkshire I have visited, with a climate to match. By good chance, the woman who was rescued had been bound for Gondor, so we have done her a double service. She has now gone on with the baby to see one of the kings of the island, a man named Gerald.
It is my sister Geraldine's ring. Of that there is no room for doubt.
Gerald, King of Exina, aged 31.
I left the Lady Geraldine in a cave near Goldeen Shore. She hadn't too long in this world, I fear.
And she had journeyed to that remote spot, you say, to bear the child.
Aye, she had. What to do then?
Do you know who is the child's father?
No. That is, I know well enough, but I swore not to tell.
Give the baby to me. What is the baby called?
Augusta.
Well, she shall keep the name, and I shall keep the child. She will call me father, and will support me in my old age.
It is a shame I have no brothers or sisters.
Yes.
A shame I have no mother living either.
A great shame.
Tabby has been telling me about her.
Indeed, and what has she told you?
That she was very beautiful. And she was born here in Gondor, but died many, many miles away on an island in the South Pacific.
You have a cousin on that distant island who is not much older than you. And from what I know of her, she would make an excellent playmate. We'll invite her here to stay the summer.
The cousin's name, Angelica. Her father is the gentle Lord Alfred, who had been married to Gerald's sister. The island they live on is called Goldeen. It is warm, luxuriant, verdant there, quite unlike Gondor, and their home is a magnificent castle. And Gerald sends word to his brother-in-law, the gentle Alfred, asking that Angelica travel to Gondor. Lord Alfred is loath to comply with Gerald's request, for Angelica, his daughter, is very dear to him. But at last he assents, not least because Angelica desires it.
Above the raging torrent, they inched their way.
Full step. Oh, and they were doomed.
They struck up an attachment from the first, did Augusta and Angelica. As if they knew, though neither could have guessed, that they were closer than mere cousins. Now, mind what you're doing,
It'll end in tears, it'll end in tears.
Though she's younger by some 2 years, she seems the elder, does my princess. She acts that way any road. It's always a right venturesome, forceful, proud little madam. And sweet Angelica yields to her in almost everything, enjoying in Augusta, I guess, what's lacking in her mild, pliant father.
Wait for me! Angelica. Blonde hair, blue eyes, pretty, very good-natured.
Mind you send your monkeys, you'll get soaked.
Sorry, Tabby.
We're at a place that the girls call the Meeting of the Waters, where streams merge as they cascade. and the single beck at the foot of the fall pushes its way over the rocky slabs. I settle myself nearby while they play, half listen to their chatter. But the sun and the walking have quite worn me out. My eyelids droop and I sleep as I sit.
Tabitha! Tabitha!
What is it?
I look at Augusta. I look beyond her. Angelica's standing with a dirty, ragged, black-haired child at her side, smiling, holding his hand.
We found him!
Yes, we found him. I found him.
Found him? Where?
Just over there. He was sitting under that tree.
I've named him Fernando, because he's olive-skinned. Fernando de Samara.
Why, has the wretch no name of his own?
We cannot tell. He says very little, and that's all gibberish.
What shall we do with him, Tabby?
How do you mean?
Well, we cannot leave him here.
The little boy comes to live at Gerald's palace, and he is cared for, nourished, and taught to communicate. For Angelica declares that she has adopted him, and Alfred, her father, calls himself Fernando's father too, because Angelica desires it. Thus wise, the three children grow up together, alternating their home between Gondel and Galdeen, and in time they are no longer children.
Emily Jane Bronte, aged 16, taller than Branwell, my brother. This irks him. He is a year older than I. Taller by some distance than my elder sister Charlotte. No doubt this irks her too, though she hides it. Brown hair, grey hazel eyes, pale complexion, chronicler of Gondel.
And whereas Angelica continues to bestow upon Fernando almost as much affection as she gives Augusta,
the princess herself is more inclined, when she condescends to show the young man any regard at all, to tease him.
In the earth thou shalt be laid, a grey stone standing over thee. Black mould beneath thee spread, and black mould to cover thee.
Who's that?
Only I, Fernando. Why do you sit here alone and sing this dirge? Is there no lady you might serenade instead? Or is Angelica your only love, and she in no need of winning over? Oh, there, don't sulk.
I'm not sulking, but whatever I say you shall see fit to make fun of, so I shall say nothing.
Fernando, 16 years old, or thereabouts, precise age uncertain. Height 6 feet, hair black, eyes dark, complexion swarthy.
I love to walk along these battlements. But this evening in particular, I am come to escape the presumptuous attentions of a visitor to the castle. By name, Lord Alexander. What do you make of him, Fernando?
I make nothing of him. I give him no heed.
Nor should you. A shallow and self-complacent young man he is. Though also, I own, quite handsome. He's in love with me, he says.
Emily and Anne set out for a walk upon the moors.
I wonder what shall become of us, Anne, and where we shall be in future years. Shall Branwell's life be devoted to painting, to literature, or to music, or miraculously to all three? Charlotte, of course, will be a teacher or a governess.
I likewise, I expect, says Anne.
Yes, I would rather not be a teacher, except to teach myself. Today, at any rate, I shall be the Princess Augusta. What, I wonder, will become of her? You remember, Anne, that when we saw her last, she was at Aspen Castle in Galdeen?
Emily! Anne! Someone is toiling up the steep hill from the parsonage.
Patrick Branwell Bronte. Unruly red hair, his chief feature. Spectacles on a Roman nose, diminutive frame, grand ambitions.
He draws near. Where are you headed?
We had not thought. Pond and Kirk, the meeting of the waters.
Splendid, says Branwell. Whichever.
Often when Anne and I are alone, we play the Gondel game, dividing the parts between us.
I could hear you getting ready to go out, says Branwell.
At other times, I continue the game inside my head and manage all the parts myself.
Papa, though, said I must finish the death of Socrates. Ye Olympian gods, but the old Greek goat was an unconscionable time making his adieu.
The scene, a field near Aspen Castle, a hunt is in progress.
What has happened?
My horse has gone lame.
He looks fit enough.
No, he cannot take the jumps. You should not trouble yourself to stay, sir. Have you no wish to keep up with the hounds?
No, in truth, I have not.
The chase doesn't excite you?
Oh, that it does. But last night it went cold on me, and I am keen to renew it.
It seems, Lord Alexander, that though you are a man of few ideas, the few you have are quite fixed.
I am besotted with you, if that's your meaning.
I was told that you were leaving today. Have you suddenly business to attend to?
Thank God, no. It was never my intention to leave so soon. I gave out the story to see what reaction it might prompt from you.
Oh, you did. So, I must add low cunning and vanity to your inventory of qualities.
Well, the ruse worked well enough, inasmuch as it led to another.
How do you mean?
Your horse becoming lame.
My room, night. A single candle. I take out my mirror from the drawer. My sisters are of the opinion, and I try not to disabuse them, that I take little interest in my appearance. This is true, but only insofar as I spend very little time attempting to improve it. I search the eyes. They answer back from the glass. I am what I am. Emily Jane Bronte. Flesh, dust, death in potentiality. A warm breath from the window causes the light to flicker. In the glass now, Augusta's smiling face. The game never ceases.
Why am I marrying Alexander?
To make Fernando jealous, there's one good reason.
Yes, yes.
And for another, to punish Alexander for being a ladies' man. Or trying to be.
I do wish, Angelica, that you and Fernando could be pleased for me.
You are leaving us, and that's no cause for making a jubilee. But I will be happy, I swear it, if Alexander makes you so. I shall never marry.
Never? What nonsense.
It's true. Sister, you must not tell this to a single soul, least of all Fernando. But for me, there's no man breathing compares to him, and it is he and only he I want. I have no reason to suppose that he might return my affection. And even if he did, we would not marry, having been brought up as brother and sister. But I love him, Augusta. I love him, and with so much more than a sister's love.
Thus speaks Angelica. Meanwhile, several thousand miles away in Gondor, a secret meeting is in progress between the heads of the two most powerful kingdoms of the island. Gerald of Exina, on the one hand, he whom Augusta knows as her father. On the other, Julius, king of Angora in the northern region, which for centuries has been in hostility with Exina.
Julius, these notions I have no quarrel with. If the various kingdoms of Gondor could be allied in a government of national accord, they would, I am certain, all become more prosperous and more secure.
Fine, we are agreed then.
We shall see, because the question is begged. How will this confederation be administered? Who will rule?
You were wondering, I take it, whether I intend to nominate myself to lead a united Gondor. I do.
Julius, age 44, over 6 feet tall, dark hair, dark eyes, thin lips, Roman nose.
In that case, Julius, you cannot expect...
I also nominate you, Gerald of Exina. Dear friend, I propose a twin kingship. You and I, Gerald, in glorious fraternity.
Now, Gerald is by temperament a cautious man, but he can see no way in which
move
he
your
or that matter the people of Exina, though he cares somewhat less about them.
Emily Jane?
Can possibly suffer by Julius's scheme.
Stop your scribbling, will you, and peel a potato.
No, no, I will not peel a potato. Nor will I tidy my bed, nor will I do the music exercise, B major, which aren't a set me. Rather, I will persist in scribbling. I will scribble on my paper. I will scribble on your face.
That you won't give over. Heck, all this pitter-pottering instead of peeling the potato. I can't do with it.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear, oh, dear. I'm sorry, Tabitha. I'll peel the potatoes directly.
What happens next is this. Treachery, betrayal. Once Gerald has signed the agreement with Julius, his guard is dropped, as Julius hoped it would be. And within 6 months, Julius attacks the kingdom of Exina, meeting at first with scant resistance. That much I know. That much I tell Anne. But I lack the heart to play the game. Papa called me into the parlour this morning. The plan, he says, is that at the end of July I depart with Charlotte for Miss Wooler's school. Charlotte to teach, I to learn. This will be the first occasion I've been away from home since I was 6 years of age and was at the school at Cowan Bridge with Charlotte and our two elder sisters, Mariah and Elizabeth.
I am Emily Jane Bronte.
Mariah, being severely ill, was brought back home from the school and she died. Elizabeth, likewise.
I give life and I take it away.
In 2 days, Emily will be 17. Tomorrow, she must leave for Roe Head. She and Anne are sewing in the dining room. I suppose, says Anne, that the news of the invasion has reached Galdean by this time. Emily looks up.
Oh, yes, assuredly.
And Augusta, continues Anne, is even now hurrying to return to Gondel alone.
No, not alone. Alexander goes with her.
Oh, says Anne, but what prompts him? When their marriage is already a miserable thing and neither seems to care for the other. Is it some unexpected sense of obligation?
Perhaps, but also, and in equal measure, self-spite.
Captain, what news?
It goes badly, Your Highness.
We know that much.
Julius's army has broken through towards Lake Elna. Exina's doom is as good as certain.
Where is the king, my father?
The king, your father, is gone.
Gone? What? He's fled.
A day since.
You're lying.
Would to God it were so.
Where was he bound?
Galdean. He intends, it seems, to stay in hiding at Aspin Castle, his brother-in-law's home.
Father! Father!
In blackest despondency, she shuts herself away within the palace, and for several hours sees no one. Then Tabitha, her maid, comes, tells her that Lord Alexander is at Lake Elnor, at the battlefield. He's been wounded, and badly, too.
Foolish man! Brave man! That he should risk his life for a country not his own, while my father...
She must find him. She orders a carriage to be brought to the west door. Goodbye, Tabby.
Goodbye, Emily Jane. Be good.
Goodbye, house. Goodbye, garden. Back soon. In my pocket, a sprig of heather I plucked from the edge of the moors this morning. I won't cry. Not one tear shall they see. Goodbye. Southern edge of the lake, she finds Alexander still holding on to life. The princess kneels down, kisses him, and cradles his head in her lap.
One shot only I fired. I pray to God it hit its mark. Well, Augusta, this was a fast and certain road to death. An idiot's martyrdom.
He dies. And though news reaches her that the forces of King Julius are winning the day and are destined to break through, Augusta resolves to remain with her husband.
It's my over! Over! No! Stay! Hold!
I am not fleeing.
Find her!
Listen, my husband's body is unburied.
Well, he's past caring. Find her!
A good morning to you, Princess Augusta.
He holds a torch in his hand, and so fierce is the brightness of its flame that she has to shield her eyes as she looks upon her visitor's features.
Permit me, Augusta, to introduce myself.
Spare yourself the trouble. I know who you are. And it surprises me, King Julius, since you know who I am, that you could have permitted me to be kept in prison for so long.
For so long, you have kept your silence concerning Gerald. Advise us where Gerald is, and if you speak the truth, you will be free.
Well, you say so, but why should I trust your word when you broke it with my father? And what kind of freedom would it be to be burdened with the guilt of betraying him?
You are a brave young woman, Augusta, and you will need to be. Tomorrow another interrogator comes, and he'll use more than words to obtain the answer. Farewell, Princess. We may not meet again.
He inclines his head. She does not offer him her hand, but he grasps it and pulls it towards him. He stops, breathes out an exclamation. Still holding her hand, he stares at it in wonderment, for there is a ring upon the middle finger,
and though he has not seen that ring for full 20 years, he recognizes it straight away, and his face pales, and his lips tremble.
How came you by this ring?
Now that I can tell you, what I know. It was given me by my father.
Indeed. How did he obtain it?
From my mother.
And she is...
dead. She died in giving birth to me.
What was her name?
Geraldine.
Geraldine.
And know you not that Geraldine was also the name of your father's sister?
Yes.
But you were told, I suppose, that your mother and Gerald's sister were two beings, not one and the same.
Of course. What are you saying? This is all to turn me against my father. To tell me now that I was born of an incestuous union.
No, Augusta. That you are not. For Gerald is not your father.
Not my father? Who is my father, pray?
He looks at her, at her dark eyes and raven hair, and his own eyes fill with tears, and he smiles.
The dormitory. The girls are gone for their lessons, and Emily lies here alone.
What delight, despite my sickness, to be away from the foolish faces, the silly chatter. I have eaten little these past 4 days. This is my revenge. This shall be my escape, one way or the other. For the truth is, I shall either leave this place soon or die here.
Charlotte comes to her bed.
Charlotte Bronte, age 19, height 4'10", hair, silky eyes, reddish brown.
Emily, she says.
There is a wan smile upon my lips.
Emily, are you awake?
I give the faintest nod.
What are you thinking of?
The moors.
She sits by Emily's side, takes her hand. I'm going to request, she says, that you leave here as soon as possible.
I make a protest of a sort. There is silence, then.
I had a dream last night, says Charlotte, about poor Maria and Elizabeth.
I see nothing. I know now that I'm going home. She travels in a fine gilt carriage drawn by 6 greys. Her destination is King Julius's palace in Angora. Julius is with her, as is Tabitha, Augusta's maid. As they travel, Julius tells the princess of how 20 years before he had taken his army to the island of Galdin to capture what he could of it, of how he had encamped outside the walls of the city of Zelona, whose viceroy, the gentle Lord Alfred, was absent, and how Geraldine, Alfred's brave and beautiful wife, had come to Julius in his tent and had pleaded for the city to be spared.
Of a sudden I found I had no thirst for battle. My soldiers rested, and I devoted all my efforts to winning Geraldine, not the city.
And you won?
Yes, Augusta, I won.
For the while?
Our love was a secret love.
Well, almost secret.
Secret at least from Alfred, her husband. But though she loved me, she loved him too. And she loved her little daughter, Angelica. She would not, despite my entreaties, come with me to Gondel. And so in time I returned home alone. I never had word from her again. Know nothing of what befell her.
But Tabitha knows, I think.
I'm in the dining room. Outside, grey clouds in a hurry and darker clouds behind. Guilty thoughts about leaving Miss Wooler's are compounded by the likelihood that Anne will be required to go there in my place. Branwell is home, which I had not but might have anticipated. The plan for taking up his art studies is abandoned. He reached London, it seems, but never presented himself at the Academy schools. Will not give the reason for this. Rather, he will, but each time his tale is different. I won't condemn him. If he failed, so did I. But my real failure, surely, is the guilt I feel.
Dearest father.
In the palace in Angora, meanwhile.
You know, I marvel that you can so quickly forgive me.
Forgive you?
For invading Exina, for subjugating its people, for being the cause of your husband's death.
Before I knew you as I do now, I would not have forgiven you. But now, I would not have forgiven you if you had acted in any other way. For you are as you are. And what you are, you must be with all your heart and all your mind and all your soul and all your strength.
Augusta, truly you are my daughter.
Julius leaves his daughter's room. Augusta stands at the open door, hears his tread along the short corridor to his own chamber. She hears the guard standing to attention. She hears Lord Eldred.
A good night to you, Your Highness.
And to you.
She is happy. She lies across her bed, her lazy arm thrown back, one foot still touching the floor.
The king is wounded!
Augusta leaps from her bed.
Father!
Rushes out into the corridor.
Father!
She hurls herself barefoot towards Julia's chamber.
Guards!
The guards, confused, react too slowly. The assassin throws himself past them, runs in Augusta's direction.
Death to tyrants!
Augusta stops still in the man's path and looks from the dripping blade to the face, whose nobility is twisted into an ugly and malignant grimace.
Away, woman!
In that small second, she memorizes every feature. She will know him again. He darts towards one side of her. She moves too, grabs his arm.
Off, wait, stop!
He succeeds in transferring the knife to his free hand, jabs at her with it 5 or 6 times, only now the blood spurting from several fountains in her side as she loosens her grip. She falls to the floor, the blood still gushing freely, but diluted now by her tears. Lord Eldred rushes up to her, kneels.
Do not try to rise. I will call the physician.
My father!
He, I fear, is beyond all help.
Lord Eldred, you were my father's loyal and wise advisor, and you shall be mine in turn.
The very utmost I can do for you and Gondol, I shall. And if you hope to lay a claim to Gondol's throne, what I counsel is, do nothing. By which I mean, follow the example of the Roman, Fabius, and, with cunning, delay. Wait till your support is grown stronger, and till those who might oppose you are weakened by mutual suspicion and internecine war. Then, strike.
She takes Lord Eldred's advice, but she also asks that Gerald be sought out and captured, convinced as she is that it was he who had instigated her father's death. So Gerald is caught, and he is put in prison on the island of Galdine.
I'm here on father's behalf to plead for Gerald.
Then you have travelled in vain. Here, keeper, come. Good boy.
They stop walking. Augusta takes the sealed envelope from Fernando. She has dreamed of him these last weeks. In the dream, which is the same each night, he comes to her and tells her of the love they share for each other, but have never, till now, confessed.
What was your real reason in coming? Speak, Fernando.
I have been dreaming of you these past months. Every night, or as near as, and each night the same dream. I come to you here at Exina, here in the parkland near the moor.
And what then? What happens in your dream?
I tell you that I love you, and you repeat the words.
Well, we all dream.
Yes, but I came to discover whether the dream might come true.
So tell me, do you love me?
I love you.
Do not say so merely that the prophecy may be fulfilled. Dreams, in seeming to come true, can play false.
Then let me be deceived, for I cannot help myself. I love you. But that's not all my dream.
Nor all mine.
Against all hope.
They are lovers against all hope.
The dream is realized, unless it be a dream itself, which I sometimes wonder.
Fernando stays on in Gondol. He is enslaved to Augusta.
I write to Lord Alfred and to Angelica, attributing my long stay to the civil war and the difficulties it imposes upon travel. Alfred's letter, which I brought from Galdine, lies upon a table in Augusta's apartment, its seal unbroken.
What will you do?
This morning, you mean?
Yes, if you like.
I will lie at your side, if you like, and sing to you between kisses.
That you cannot do, Fernando, for I have work in hand.
By spring, the war is over, Augusta's victory is assured, and ahead of her lies the task of governing Gondor.
Work tomorrow.
Oh, I shall do that too.
Must you work today?
I must.
Oh, my princess, my princess.
Your queen?
Yes, and now that you are, what will become of your knave?
Well, love, you might return home.
Return home?
Yes. It is time you saw Aspen Castle once more.
This is no jest, is it?
Think, Fernando, how much your sweet Angelica will be missing you. Now that peace is secured in Gondor, you have no excuse for delaying.
You know that I have every excuse in the world.
Dearest Fernando. Precious boy.
He is ordered home to Galdhin. He is distraught. She is unrelenting. Lord Eldred escorts the poor youth to the harbour. He has been dismissed, he thinks, because the Queen is casting about for a suitable match to help her establish her authority, which is true enough. But there is an immediate and pressing reason for breaking the relationship, a secret which Augusta is anxious to keep from him. Not long after his departure, it is reported that Augusta has been taken ill and confined to the palace, nor is anyone permitted to see her save the physician and Tabitha, her maid.
Nay, your Mumfret. Listen, your mama, this lady who lies here, she were just such a one as thee, born on wrong side of blanket.
Enough.
Her daddy thousands of miles away.
Enough.
I beg you, tell Fernando, urge him to return. He'll love her well enough, of that I'm certain. For though she's a bastard child, she's a joy and a treasure.
I'll not tell him. And you, Tabitha, are sworn to silence. He must never know.
What will you call the babe?
I know not. You name her.
No, I named thee. That's true enough.
Then turn a precedent into a tradition, Tabitha. You name her. The baby is asleep in her cot. I take her into my arms, wrap her up warmly. Well, I must, because we are going outside, and she ought not catch cold. We leave my room. She is still asleep. Candles on the wall. I keep my eyes from her face, lest she weaken my resolve. Alexandria, Tammy calls her. If Fernando is not to be her father, she says, then let her name be in memory of my husband. But I'd sooner she had no name. The snow is already thick upon the ground. She's awake now. I press her close to me. Good mother. Kind mother. Where are we going? To Adele, dear child. To Adele on the wars. We reach the place. I put her down upon the snow. I stand, my head bowed.
Tell me where the bairn is.
I shall not tell you.
Tell me what you've done with her.
In God's name, no! I'm not accountable to you.
Say at least that she's still alive.
Leave me, Tabitha.
Where is my pretty one?
Leave me! Leave me! Never talk of her again!
The South Pacific. Queen Augusta looks out at the approaching coastline. The last time she was on Galdhin to stay at Aspen Castle, she was 17. Her marriage to Alexander, the war in Gondor, Alexander's death, her imprisonment, all this was to come. Since her visit, She has gained a father and lost him. While Gerald, who had claimed her as his own, is now on this very island, on Augusta's orders, shut away for life in the prison caves. Why is Augusta returning to Gauldin? She has come to claim a husband, though this is as yet kept a secret, not least from Fernando. The battlements, Aspin Castle. On this spot, when they were younger, Augusta teased Fernando and fanned the flames of his jealousy.
I have been talking with Angelica. She asked me if I would spend some time with you.
Otherwise, no doubt, you would not have troubled yourself. I love you.
Fernando.
Let me touch the sleeve of your dress. Smell your hair. Hear you breathing. For each hour without your company, I swear it, I'm in the lowest pit of hell.
Well, it was this that sweet Angelica asked me to discover. I mean, the cause of your decline. For it appears you have not been so open with her. Am I to tell her what you have told me?
I cannot.
She will be greatly distressed. She is in love with you, in her way.
That is her misfortune, but I have mine.
She can offer him, she says, no reason for hope. She leaves Fernando to his tears, goes downstairs to the library, where it has been arranged that at this hour, gentle Lord Alfred, Angelica's father, should see her, and give the Queen his answer to the proposal she made on her arrival at Aspin Castle. She discovers him already there, ill at ease, preoccupied.
Will you not speak?
Forgive me. I had my words worked out, every one with due care. I was intending... To be frank, I was intending to tell you how much I was moved by your suggestion, but that I had resolved not to marry again. Also that there were insuperable difficulties to my being wedded to one so much younger, one so closely related to me by birth, one whom I have become accustomed over the years to treat as a father would his child.
That was your speech?
It was, in brief. But when you walked in here, just now, and I looked at your face, your smile...
And it was Geraldine's smile. And then and there, he forgave his Geraldine her adultery.
Your answer is yes?
It is. It is. Oh. How could it be otherwise?
Anne left home this morning. She is to be a governess at Thorpe Green, which is near York. The farewell scene... Anne in her cloak and hood, standing quiet and demure amid the chatter and fuss. Mr. Whiteman, the young curate, rushing up to her, proffering a small package and murmuring something I cannot hear. Anne half smiles, lowers her gaze. Anne Bronte, age 20, hair light brown, eyes blue bordering upon violet, complexion pale, almost transparent, a strong believer. Poor Anne. She is fond of Whiteman, I'm sure. But since he came to Haworth, he has been in love with a myriad young women, so that even by acknowledging his attention, she must feel she is being mocked. Such folly.
Keeper! Keeper!
No one shall use me. No one shall presume upon me. No one shall say that I am his. I am as I am. I shall never accommodate myself, be diminished. If I were to have a lover, if there were to be someone, he would be my soul's other soul. And we each would love the other as we loved ourselves. We would be two equal parts in one, equal in misery perhaps on this earth, our love being too great for this world to encompass or our mortal frames to bear. But a blessed duality in death, at least. Well, we all dream.
Come, keeper! Good boy.
I could spend the rest of my life just here, as it is today. I would have this scene repeated and repeated in an endless cycle. You in your white gown, walking by the flowers, and putting their beauty to shame. The slanting sun, the dappled shadows cast on your face by the trees.
Dear Alfred... Pray for just 1 minute more, not a lifetime.
I see we are about to be disturbed.
A servant approaches from the south door, announces that Angelica desires her father's presence. Little else would have enticed him from Augusta just then. He kisses her thrice or more, swears as often that he will not be long, and hurries away. Augusta turns and sits on a bench beneath the pines, takes in their sweet aroma, almost closes her eyes. She loves her Alfred, or at least loves the fact that he dotes on her.
Who is that? Who is it?
I didn't startle you, I hope.
Fernando.
May I sit here?
He will be back soon.
Well, in the time it takes him to discover the servant's message had no substance.
I see.
Oh, do not fear, Augusta. I have no intention of making a fool of myself. Have you not noticed how I've taken the news of your engagement? Of course, I could not emulate Angelica's enthusiasm, but at least I have made attempts to be calm, in my outward manner, sociable, even.
Your conduct, Fernando, has been beyond reproach, and I thank you for that.
But still, I think you do not trust me, for you know how strong were the chains that bound us, how futile it was to try and break them.
It is over!
It is barely beginning, Augusta. My own. And it stretches into eternity. Here is the knife, Augusta. This shall serve us. The plan is this. I shall lay you down here. I shall lay you down. And I shall lie down beside you. So that as we die, our blood will flow together. Intermingle. Dearest one, do not cling to life. In death there shall be no obstacle to our love. Believe me.
This is the London train.
Emily sits at the window, regarding her sister and father as much as the busy scene outside. Charlotte is perched on the edge of the seat like a little girl.
Well,
exclaimed Charlotte.
Well!
Mr. Bronte is sat next to her. His self-appointed mission is to accompany Charlotte and Emily, see to it that his daughters reach Brussels safely. For all three, it is their first trip abroad. For the sisters, it is their first trip outside the north of England. Mr. Bronte extracts his watch. The train's departure, he comments, is 3 minutes late.
It was Charlotte's idea, of course, that she, Anne, and I set up a school of our own. When with fervor she described the notion, my heart protesting cried, I want none of this. But I soon realized the scheme had some points in its favor. If I must teach, if I must contribute to our making our way in the world, I would sooner it were in a place of our own with my sisters to lend support. So I gave my assent. But there was more to it yet.
Lavinia, says Charlotte.
Lavinia is her pet name for me. I have no such name for her.
Lavinia, listen. Without languages, the project is entirely hopeless. What is required is a period of study abroad.
Where will you go?
Brussels, she replies.
She had it planned, you see, for herself and for me.
But I would not reap this benefit alone, she says, though, sadly, it is not possible for both you and Anne to accompany me.
Charlotte Bronte, face square, nose large, mouth crooked.
Emily, this gift you deserve. Come with me to Brussels. I approach them. Augusta is quite still. Fernando is standing holding the knife out in front of him. I stop a few yards away, glance round. There are some half dozen servants coming to my aid.
I would have killed her. I admit it. But when I heard you raise the alarm...
Put down the knife.
I feared I might be thwarted and be unable to take my own life too. So, you see, she is spared. The knife is unbloodied.
Lay it down.
She will be mine, though. Living or dead, she will.
He runs off, escapes. Augusta lives. She tells Alfred about the poor youth's hopeless infatuation with her, affirming that his feelings were neither solicited nor reciprocated. As for Angelica,
She assumes the attack was prompted by Fernando's devotion towards Alfred and consequent jealousy of Augusta, and no attempt is made to persuade her otherwise. Within a month, Augusta and the gentle Alfred are married. Exhausted and starved from being on the run, Fernando gives himself up and is taken to the prison caves.
Visitor, see you.
Visitor?
It is I, see you, brother.
Sherlock.
Oh, my sweet Amadeus.
Oh, call me not by that name, for I'll not make music anymore. Are you well?
Hardly, and shall not be till you are out of here. But there's no talk yet of that.
How is father?
He is well.
And Augusta?
Yes, and the two of them are wondrously fond of each other. But fear not, my dearest. Father's love for you, as for me, is quite undiminished.
Who told you Gerald was here?
My father, Lord Alfred.
He did wrong, your father.
He feared that whilst I was visiting Fernando, I would discover Gerald's presence anyway, and he therefore urged me not to speak to him, advising me it would distress the Queen.
Here we are, then. Go on. Speak to him.
Uncle, it is I, Angelica.
Put your hands through the grill. Let me touch them. Are you here because she is at last relenting?
No. I have, I confess, gone expressly against Augusta's wishes in visiting you.
Sweet child, I wish to ask of you a favor.
What is that, Uncle?
I would fain you sought out an acquaintance of mine. Scotland is his home country, and Lanark, where he lived in his youth, but where he is now I cannot be sure. Of noble birth he is, or claims to be, and his name is Robert Douglas. Find him for me.
I will do what I can. And if I am successful, what am I to say to him?
I am dying here. Do you understand? My limbs are atrophied and gangrenous. What scraps of food I get, I cannot digest. I'm dying. But I want Augusta dead first.
Angelica is, as she must be, greatly affected by Gerald's fate. But his entreaties cannot move her, for she will not be party to any plan that threatens the person of the Queen whom she loves. She returns to Gondel, but of the meeting with her uncle she says nothing, fearing that Augusta would be angered, and that as a result her pleas for the release of Fernando might be prejudiced.
Have Lord Eldred go to the prison. See the conditions under which my brother is held.
That will not be necessary.
Let Fernando be taken to a place that is secure but not injurious. What he did to you, what he intended, I own, was unpardonable, but...
I can pardon it, if I wish. You must not think, Angelica, that I imprisoned Fernando as punishment for his crime. Prison, rather, was where I hoped he might lie forgotten, so that I might be Gondel's queen without distraction or interference. A vain hope!
What are you saying?
I'm saying I'm in love with him.
No. No.
It's the truth, Angelica. And I tell you it to hurt you.
Brussels. A letter comes from Branwell. Aunt is dead. This news causes me sadness, but not as much, I suppose, as it should.
Alfred enters my apartment. He is perturbed, anxious.
Can it be true? What I've heard? Do you really intend to release Fernando?
I smile, nod my head.
Augusta, this is madness! What reason have you to suppose, if set free, he will not make a second attempt upon your life?
We pack for the trip home. No, Charlotte, I tell my sister, once everything is settled at Haworth, you must return to Brussels and your studies. I shall stay and look after Papa. And am I wrong to worship where faith cannot doubt nor hope despair, since my own soul can grant my prayer? Speak, God of visions, plead for me, and tell why I have chosen thee. November the 9th. Charlotte and I reached home yesterday, and I discovered that my hawk and my geese had been given away. We were too late for Aunt's funeral. This afternoon, Anne and I walk on the moors. I say to her, "Well, Anne, it seems the time has come for Fernando's release, and from this I think no good can come."
Silence. Then at last, I cannot play at Gondel today, says Anne.
Why? Is it because of her grief at Aunt Branwell's death? She was Aunt's favourite. And at Mr. Whiteman's? Now that he is dead, he will probably become the love of her life. Such is the way of it. Or is it because the Gondel game no longer pleases?
I'm sorry, says Anne.
Queen Augusta, for instance, I find a source of ever-increasing delight. But Anne, I suspect, is grown out of sympathy with her and with me for making Augusta what she is. Well, there's nothing can be done. I intend sticking by my Gondel queen. Anne and I reach the place we call the Meeting of the Waters.
Halt! This is the spot! You, prisoner!
Forgive me, I thought I'd gained my freedom.
Not yet! Prisoner! Dismount!
What now?
You are to wait here till you are told you are free!
The troop leaves and the horse I have ridden goes too. Confused, I look around at the cliff and the waters that splash their hurried way down into the stream that runs below. The location seems familiar. The more so, the longer I wait. When, I wonder, might I have been here before?
You were there, exactly where you are standing now, when first I set eyes on you.
Augusta!
Angelica found you, took your hand. Do you remember?
Augusta!
This time I have found you, and I have come to set you free.
This is a dream.
This is better than a dream.
No coward soul is mine. No trembler in the world's storm-troubled sphere. I see heaven's glories shine, and faith shines equal, arming me from fear.
Late, the bedroom. She is sitting at the window. She is Emily Jane Bronte, parson's daughter, who today baked bread in the kitchen.
O God within my breast, almighty, ever-present deity, life that in me hast rest, as I, undying life, have power in thee.
She is also Emily Jane Bronte, poet, she who invokes her God of visions, and from whose pen come words of courage, independence, and resolution.
Vain are the thousand creeds that move men's hearts, unutterably vain, worthless as withered weeds, or idlest froth amid the boundless main. Though earth and moon were gone, and suns and universes ceased to be, and thou were left alone, every existence would exist in thee.
She is also Augusta, Queen of Gondol, powerful, willful.
So then, you love Fernando?
I love you both. Dearest Alfred, my capacity for love is not finite. That I love Fernando does not mean I love you less. Rather, I love you all the more. For my fondness for each of you is somehow stimulated and enhanced by the feeling I hold for the other. Say you understand.
I understand.
Say you believe.
I believe. Well, I must, since my love for you is undiminished.
And because his wife is playing double, his pride is battered, and his antipathy towards Fernando, which he felt ever since Angelica first brought him as a child from Gondel, now is kindled into a barely restrained hatred. But the gentle Alfred urges himself to be accommodating and to bide his time, a thing which his rival cannot do. January 3rd, 1843. Aunt's will provides Charlotte, Anne and myself each with £350. So now I would kiss farewell to our school plans, since the need for money is no longer pressing. Charlotte, school or no school, intends to resume her studies at Brussels. Anne returns as governess to the Robinsons at Thorpe Green, and Branwell goes with her to be a tutor to their boy. I am at home. And elsewhere.
I must speak with you.
And, my dearest, you shall later.
Now, Augusta, now! When first I was released from prison and came to the palace, I thought I should be happy, having been granted my liberty, and, which meant far more, your love. But this love, I have discovered, is merely a portion of your love.
Not so.
Very well, all your love, for in truth you cannot feel the merest grain of affection for the creature that calls himself your husband. You look on him as you would a fawning dog, but you wish, it seems, to put a curb upon your love for me and mine for you. You allot to it particular hours and places. Tell me, I must wait my turn.
I am disappointed in you, Fernando. I would have thought those months alone would have taught you better.
Oh, trust me, it's harder to endure this present torment than it was to be deprived of you entirely.
So what will you do?
I will love you. What will you do?
I will allow you a week. That's all. If by then you've not seen sense, why, I shall send you into exile for life.
Have you no pity, no remorse?
This is yesterday's scene, Angelica.
To lead him on as you did.
Foolish woman. You couldn't endure it, could you, if you thought he loved me of his own volition?
To give him every encouragement. And then, when you contrive at him to drop a casual hint that you will see him no more, that he is banished for life.
Alfred.
My queen.
I'd be obliged, when we are returned from our ride, if you would talk with your daughter. She is still not reconciled to Fernando's fate.
I'll talk with her.
You'll talk. A fine father who would condone the rank injustice, the malevolence shown towards his son.
Angelica.
Your face, you know, has been the perfect picture of smug contentment since the day his exile was announced. Let us go, Alfred.
With pleasure.
You never loved him.
I did my best for him, Angelica, out of love for you.
You never loved him.
I've liked him less these past months, that much I'll allow. What love has he shown me to act as he has done? Let go the rein.
Show compassion for my sake. Plead with Augusta to revoke her command.
No, let go the rein.
She clings on. He tries to push her away.
Papa, Papa!
His face glows crimson with rage. He grips his riding whip and raises it. What now? Fernando is to be banished and let Angelica go with him. The insolence and disrespect she showed her father cannot surely be overlooked. Augusta tells Alfred what she intends. Oh, how love has altered him. One mortal alone he cares for, and the heart that burns fiercely for Augusta is set as cold as ice and hard like marble towards the rest of the world, even towards his daughter, upon whom he once had doted. He readily agrees to Angelica's banishment.
Amadeus, my Amadeus, do not ask what will become of us. We will live, we will die.
Say then at least why we are bound this way.
There is an inn a few miles along this route, so the shepherd said.
Well, the place that last night lodged us was agreeable enough. Must we go on?
They are riding across bleak and beautiful moors. A month and over the two exiles have been in Scotland, and all that time Angelica has kept secret from Fernando the details of her plan.
Robert Douglas. Aye, I ken a man of that name. Though whether it were the name he were born with, I cannot tell you.
He claims he is of noble blood.
Aye.
His home was in Lanark.
Aye.
I wish to see him.
Lass, there's a good few who'd like to do that.
She tells him she is from Galdin, that she is the niece of Gerald of Exina, who is imprisoned, and that Gerald is known to Douglas. And when the crofter leaves the inn, he takes with him half of Angelica's gold, promising to return with Douglas, or with news of him. They are in hiding, Fernando and Angelica. The crofter did not, as he promised, return to the inn. In his stead came a troop of redcoats, and it was only by giving the landlord the remainder of their gold that Angelica and Fernando were able to escape. They were rumored to be outlaws, and for that reason became such.
Perdition take my soul. I should not have loved Augusta. But what could I do to help myself?
Angelica does not hear him. She is asleep on the floor near the fire, worn out by the long trek that has taken them to this shell of a cottage.
Sleep on, dear sister. You've heard these words often enough before.
He removes his coat and lays it over her. Then he pulls aside the sacking that serves as a door to their hovel and goes out.
How gloomy grows the night. 'Tis Gondel's wind that blows. I shall not tread again the deep glens where it rose. I feel it on my face. Where, wild blast, dost thou roam? What do we, wanderer, here, so far away from home? I do not need thy breath to cool my death-cold brow, but go to that far land where she is shining now.
Tell her my latest wish, tell her my dreary doom. Say that my pangs are past, but hers are yet to come.
Branwell is home. Sad, pathetic Branwell. He is in love with Mrs. Robinson, the mother of the boy he was tutoring. He receives a letter from the father. He is dismissed from his position. Sad, pathetic Charlotte, meanwhile, who returned from the pensionnat 18 months since, is still in love with her Brussels professor. But the correspondence is all one way. As for Anne, her darling cannot be contacted at all, except across the Great Divide.
Augusta, Augusta.
It is you, my Fernando.
Nothing in this world is more miserable than a wretch laid low by love.
Be true to me. Be true to yourself.
Unless it be the wretch who has never loved at all. This condition of mine, this tendency to stand aside and watch others with a pitying smile, it would suit better, would it not, if it came from experience. But the situation is this. Because I am as I am, I have called up the philosophy that suits me, pretended that I expressly chose this solitary path, that I preferred it, told myself that if ever I loved, it would be a love of a very different order. Just past 2 a.m, my bedroom. I am 27 years of age. In the real world, I have done very little. I have lived in the parsonage chiefly, safe, largely undisturbed. Taken on an undemanding role, made a tiny virtue out of my need to be at home, and paraded my reluctance to be away. And my mind, for the most part, I have allowed to be untethered, at play, created an island and inhabited it, a place I love because it is mine own, but which I have begun to wonder if I can ever leave. Why should I wish to escape Gondor? For this reason, to discover if it can be done. I do not like to think that if I was of a mind to, I could not walk free. That notion has begun to frighten me. Part of myself, my chief part, I think, is held on that island, imprisoned, and it was I who locked the door. Where the key is now, I know not, nor if I have the strength to turn it, should the key be found. I want to turn it, just to try. But oh, I fear I am so very weak of will.
She lies upon her bed, her pallid face streaked with tears.
I saw him, Alfred. I saw him.
She means Fernando, of course. She saw him in her dream. This is nothing new.
He was in a mire, walking from the edge towards the deeper part, walking on until the water splashed against his face. On, on. And when I found him, his body was afloat just beneath the surface.
Unconquered in my soul, the tyrant rules me still.
His mouth gaped open as if he were talking to me. His eyes stared cold at mine.
Life bows to my control.
His long hair floated and coiled around his head like some living thing.
But love I cannot kill.
I love him, Alfred.
But he is dead, you say.
He is dead. And I love him more fiercely now than ever I did.
That was wrong of you. That was very wrong.
Yes, says Charlotte. Perhaps.
It's my own private notebook.
Yes. Her face is white.
If I had wished that you see the poems...
I know, murmurs Charlotte. There is a brief silence. Emily glares at her sister.
My book. Mine.
Yes. Charlotte knew she would have this price to pay, but it's a hard price nonetheless. And she feels, too, that Emily may be indulging herself in her reaction. Yes, she agrees. Your book. But it was left open.
Perhaps it was, but that was no invitation. And anyway, you have read several pages.
I have read every page, exclaims Charlotte. She's fighting back.
Every page?
I'm sorry, she continues. Sorry that you're so distressed. But what I have done, I cannot really regret.
At which she heaps praise upon the poems, as if this mitigates her fault, or is likely to placate me. Charlotte Bronte, head too large for her stunted, squat body.
Lavinia,
This is poetry that must be published.
Along with her own, I've no doubt. Charlotte, this poetry is mine.
Emily plays hard to appease. Indeed, when she at last yields to the notion of a published volume of poems, she is, it seems, still not reconciled, but acts out of selflessness and goodwill.
I say to Anne, the work involved in the book's preparation will be beneficial for Charlotte.
For Charlotte has indeed, though less ostentatiously than her brother, been much desponding on account of blighted love.
So for that reason, I say to Anne, for that reason, I will not stand in her way.
The book is published. Poems by Currer,
Ellis,
and Acton Bell.
Of course it is satisfying to be in print, even when the book is put out at one's own expense. Nevertheless,
Emily will not tell her sisters so. And when a mere 2 copies are sold, she seems indifferent.
Nevertheless,
she has been caught by something of Charlotte's determination to push the boat out a little further. A little further, yes. But where? And who will lead the way?
Passages in the life of an individual.
Anne smiles wryly. The individual's life is, as yet, incomplete, she says. But if you would care to read what's done so far...
And you wrote all this while at Thorpe Green?
Yes, says Anne.
You must tell me, dear sister, who is this individual?
Well, replies sweet, gentle Anne, she does not belong to Gondor. She blushes, turns away. She feels almost that she has committed an act of betrayal.
So, who is this person?
She's a governess.
A governess? Why then, it's you.
Anne raises her eyebrows a little, shakes her head. The work is not an autobiography, she says.
A novel, based on your experience.
Yes, replies Anne, sighing. And I wish it were finished.
Very well, then.
She goes to her room. She's enthused. Piqued, too, that Anne should have stolen a march on her.
A new epic. A new fantasy.
She brings out from beneath the bed a large tin box, a red one. She removes the lid. Looks inside. Touches the contents with a tenderness she resents.
Notebooks, laundry books.
Sheets of paper tied with ribbon.
Burn them, if you dare. Burn them all.
At the bottom of the box, small volumes, their pages stitched together. Early works, these, produced when Emily was 13, 14, though the handwriting has hardly changed over the years. In some, the Gondol Chronicles.
A solution. An escape route from Gondol, but without severing all links. I shall write something intended for public consumption. Whether it can be to public taste is another matter, but I shall make it Gondol in spirit.
We have come to an island. Gondol, the inhabitants call it.
If it had a local setting, which I would like best, it would be Gondol still.
This part at least consists of wild moorland, not unlike parts of Yorkshire I have visited.
As to plot and characters, Gondol surely would serve well too. Better, at any rate, than passages in the life of an individual named Emily Jane Bronte, which wouldn't do at all.
Chapter 1.
It shall be contemporary, or nearly so.
1801. I have just returned from a visit to my landlord, the solitary neighbour I shall be troubled with.
Like Gondol, though, the story shall stretch across the years. A saga.
In all England, I do not believe that I could have fixed on a situation so completely removed from the stir of society. A perfect misanthropist's heaven.
A house set on the moors. A family feud.
And Mr. Heathcliff and I are such a perfect pair to divide the desolation between us.
No. Two families, two houses, fortunes intertwined. The one family, like Gondol, vigorous, rough, passionate. The other, like Galdine, soft, weak, indulged. A love affair, like Fernando's and Augusta's. The man, Heathcliff, shares Fernando's dark-skinned, gypsy appearance. His mysterious origin, too.
We crowded round, and over Miss Cuffy's head I had a peep at a dirty, rugged, black-haired child. I was frightened, and Mrs. Earnshaw was ready to fling it out of doors.
The woman, Cathy, like Gondol's queen, wanton, impulsive, love of two men, Heathcliff and a rival, the men polar opposites in character and temperament, as Fernando and Alfred. The rival she marries, but Heathcliff cannot be denied. Passion, its wildness, rage, devotion, grandeur, outside marriage, beyond the grave, the kind of love that would be mine, if I could make it so.
Augusta,
Augusta!
Oh, I dreamt, but not of my Fernando. You know why it is he visits me less often now. He fears I'll rest contented with those visions of him.
I wish to talk.
Oh, talk, dear husband. I'll sleep some more. Come, Fernando, my soul's other soul.
Augusta!
I care not whether you rail at me or whisper soothing words, so long as you come.
Wake up, Augusta! Oh. Awake!
Let go of me!
Is there no hope? May I not, while I live, regain your love? Or must I take Fernando's way before you'll think of me with affection?
Let me go, gentle Lord Alfred.
Ah!
There's no hope whether you live or die.
She puts down her pen, shuffles together the papers on her little writing desk, reads over what she has just written. Today she has been Heathcliff. Today she has been Catherine.
And, she added musingly, the thing that irks me most is this shattered prison, after all. I'm tired of being enclosed here. I'm wearying to escape into that glorious world and to be always there, not seeing it dimly through tears and yearning for it through the walls of an aching heart.
What is written will stand. She changes nothing. She sits at the window of her room and gazes out at the gravestones and the church and the hills behind.
But there is dreaming and there is being. There is the voice of certainty and the inner voice of doubt. There is the mask of defiance, and there is the desire to please. There is a life somewhere lived by heroes and heroines, by people of epic strain who love and hate to the very extremity, who are inspired by a kind of holy madness. And there is me, in my room, in the parsonage.
Wuthering Heights is finished. Along with Anne's manuscript and Charlotte's, it is sent off, sent back. The publisher's address is scored out, a new one added. The parcel is dispatched again, and so on. A year later, Emily's novel at last finds a home.
February the 9th, 1848.
Ellis Bell, she likes her nom de plume, writes to his publisher.
Dear Mr. Newby, concerning a second book...
Newby, to be blunt, is a charlatan. Sees to the final printing of Ellis and Acton's novels, and that badly, only when the success of Currer's Jane Eyre becomes clear, and then tries to pass off Ellis as Jane Eyre's author. But when Charlotte encourages her sister to exchange Mr. Newby for her own publishers, Emily declines.
My writing proceeds, but at a steady, you might say, ponderous pace. Sir, I would not wish to hurry this latest effort. To bring something out simply because, for good or bad reasons, the name of Ellis Bell is currently known to a section of the public.
Sales of Wuthering Heights have been good. Not as good, of course, as those of Jane Eyre. And its reviewers, though allowing the work a definite sort of power, have tended to be dismayed by it or baffled. But Ellis Bell, there is no denying, has made a notable debut.
Therefore, the novel shall be ready when it is ready. And be sure that it will be good and ready... For if it is not good, you shall not have it.
Gentle Lord Alfred, meanwhile, leaves Gondor. His plan is to find Angelica and attempt some sort of reconciliation, for his heart still cleaves to his daughter, and in her, he tells himself, rests his one salvation. But by the time he reaches Scotland, she has already departed that country, and, indeed, is thought to be bound for Gondor.
September the 24th, 1848. Branwell, my brother... is dead.
Tell me then, how did he die?
Of a broken heart and broken dreams.
What will be done with his body?
It seems, Your Highness, that Lord Alfred instructed that he should be interred in England. He has relations there.
He knew he would die then. He took his own life.
I cannot say.
He was a good man. Despite everything...
Branwell lies in the church, a place that had not seen him since Aunt's funeral. Death came with little warning. Time enough, though, for the religion he had mocked and claimed he set at naught, suddenly to be rated, if not espoused. Dear Branwell, weak to the end, adding amen to his father's prayers.
Her bedroom. She sits with the little writing desk on her lap. She is ill. She caught a cold at Branwell's funeral service. For the past few weeks, she has written very little. But now, though the sickness is worse, she has shown some industry. She is engaged, one presumes, on the second novel.
No.
Is she waiting then till she is fully recovered before she takes it up again?
No.
What? Has the book been abandoned?
Abandoned? It was never begun. No second novel exists. Whatever it was, I felt no need to write it.
Ah, so Newby the charlatan has himself been cheated, and the work in progress...
Gondel. Almost, in fact, completed.
Gondel, of course.
Augusta's dear companions, the Lord Leslie and his mistress, ride out with her onto the moors.
She knows that she will die that day.
Yes, yes.
And it is a death she craves.
They dismount near a spot where Augusta had last stood in the snow some 3 years previously.
What winter floods, what showers of spring have drenched the grass by night and day. And yet, beneath that spectre ring, unmoved and undiscovered, lay a mute remembrancer of crime.
A thick, dark circle of grass has formed where she placed the baby. Here she lies down. This is the place she has chosen. Here she stays, murmurs Fernando's name, and sleeps, while her two friends wander a little distance off. In time, a woman approaches. She comes and stands over Augusta, cradling a knife. It is Angelica. Riches I hold in light esteem, and love I laugh to scorn, and lust of fame was but a dream that vanished with the morn.
Let me call a doctor, says Charlotte. Emily says nothing. Please, Emily, please, says Charlotte.
No, thank you.
Good, brave Charlotte sighs softly, gazes in distress at her sister.
And if I pray, the only prayer that moves my lips for me is, leave the heart that now I bear, and give me liberty. Yes, as my swift days near their goal, 'tis all that I implore, through life and death, a chainless soul with courage to endure.
I love you, Angelica.
So you say.
I love you. You are my one hope. Return my love, and you'll find me as true to you as any saint is true to God.
They are near a clump of trees, a good half mile or more from where Augusta is lying. The man's name is Robert Douglas. It was in Scotland they met, after Fernando's suicide. This is the man Angelica had been seeking since she arrived in that country. And though he had been loath to go to Gondel, it would be dangerous for him there, he hinted. His infatuation with her overcame his fear.
I love you.
Prove your love.
I'll do it, Angelica. Merely tell me how.
Very well. You must know that while you waited here for me, I very nearly took the life of the Queen of Gondel. I would have had my revenge just now, but as she lay upon the ground, she groaned so piteously that I could not kill her, for I did not like to cut short the pain she suffered in her sleep. You, though, will be untouched by such partiality. Take the knife. Prove your love. Her two companions slay first, then her. We are governed by one above us, whispers Charlotte, and are as clay in the hands of the potter. Nevertheless, what we can do to help ourselves, we must. I raise my eyes to hers. No doctors, Charlotte. No poisons. I confess. It is almost a pleasure for me to be in pain, to see that it hurts my sister too. Not thy will be done, but mine. I'll not renege. I'll not flinch. No coward soul is mine. No trembler in the world's storm-troubled sphere. This is the way. To act out the bravery and defiance of my imaginings. Give substance to fantasy. Be the hero in death, where in life I failed.
Our companions are no more.
The Lord have mercy on them.
And on me.
Be on your mettle. She'll have heard their cries.
Augusta runs to where the butchered lovers lie, hides her face in the pool of blood they share, and struggles back to her feet, for the moment forgetting her desire for her own death and reunion with Fernando.
Oh, I have wrongs to pay. Give life. Give vigor now.
She does not see at first where Douglas lurks. She drinks from a mossy stream. Stands up.
Charlotte waits, watches, chafing her hands together.
She turns. She meets the murderer's gaze. Her own is scorched with a sudden blaze.
There are tears in her eyes. Poor Charlotte. She loves me.
She hates me for defeating her. She urges me to go to bed. No, I say, I'll rest in here, on the sofa.
Angelica advances. Augusta sees her.
My life is yours, dear sister. But not till I have taken his...
She hurls herself at him, grabs the arm that grips the crimson knife. In her fury, she is like to overpower the astonished Douglas, when, as they grapple, her face but inches from his own, she gasps with recognition. Sees this encounter stage not upon the moors of Exina, but in the corridor outside her father's chamber, she holding the assassin's arm as now, his features freezing themselves into her memory.
You!
She gives way at last, shows some sort of compassion to her helpless, humbled sister.
If you send for a doctor, I'll see him now.
Douglas smiles. In shock and revulsion at the sight of him, the queen has pulled back, relaxed her grip. He frees his arm, steadies himself, and thrusts the blade deep into her side. She stumbles, goes some distance, crouching, falls, dies.
I am Emily Jane Bronte. I give life. I take it away.
They have come to fetch me from my bedroom where they had put me to lie. Goodbye, little room. I must go now. All is in order. My Gondel papers, including the ending of the saga, are in their tin box under the bed. They are intact, entire. Nothing has been destroyed. Down the stairs, past the clock. Down the stairs and into the hall. On the left, the parlor. On the right, the dining room. Out through the front door. Goodbye, house. Into the garden.
I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. We brought nothing in...
This way! Come, keeper, come! Good boy. Down the path. Through the gate. Goodbye, garden. And into the churchyard. I won't cry. Not one tear will they see. Past the gravestones, this way. Past the gravestones and into the church. The church next the moor. This way. This way.
Gondel was written by Martin Wade. Augusta was played by Diana Quick, and Emily Bronte by Janet Moore. Fernando was played by Nathaniel Parker, Lord Eldred by John Rowe, Alfred by Clive Francis, Tabitha by Linda Polan, and Angelica by Moya Leslie. Julius was played by Keith Drinkle, Gerald by Eric Allen, Alexander and Douglas by David Thorpe, Young Emily by Annabel Lanyon, Young Charlotte and Young Augusta by Bernadette Windsor, and Young Branwell by Jill Lidston. Other parts were played by members of the cast, with Gilly Mears, John Webb, Cyril Jenkins, and Melanie Hudson. The music was specially composed by Elizabeth Parker of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop. Gondel was directed by Cherry Cookson.